Welcome to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Karen Hope. While smaller parts of the Affordable Care Act have been in effect for the last year or two, the biggest part just started last week. On October 1st, Oklahomans eligible to purchase health insurance through the exchanges began to do so. And on January 1st, those health insurance policies begin covering previously uninsured or underinsured folks. People who previously could not afford health care insurance are finding the tax credits can help lower the cost of that purchase depending on the person's income. In Oklahoma, adopting or not adopting a number of other features of the Affordable Care Act has been controversial. And overall, the conventional wisdom is that people just don't understand who is eligible, what the insurance policies provide, and how much it'll cost. A recent panel discussion by the nonprofit journalism group Oklahoma Watch explored these questions on September 24th, 1 week before the healthcare exchanges opened. The setting is Camp's 1910 Cafe in Oklahoma City.
Welcome. We're going to start our event this evening. My name is David Fritzy. I'm executive editor of Oklahoma Watch. We're glad you joined us for our first Oklahoma Watch Out. Now, you probably think you have no idea what Oklahoma Watch is, but I'm telling you, you probably do. We're a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization, and we're all about producing in-depth and investigative journalism on some important public policy issues in the state. And the Affordable Care Act is one of those very important and very hot topics. But we're all about sort of digging beneath the surface of these issues, coming up with new trends, information, and by informing people, hoping Oklahomans can improve their lives. Quick thank yous. We want to thank Camp's 1910 Cafe and encourage you to get some food and drink for donating the space for this event. We also want to thank the Oklahoma Public Media Exchange, which will be recording this session and considering it for broadcast. And then finally, just as a matter of record, I want to say that no opinions expressed at the event necessarily represent those of Oklahoma Watch, of the Oklahoma Public Media Exchange, or of the Camp's 1910 Cafe. So let's get going. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Terry Klein, who is the Commissioner of Health and the Cabinet Secretary of Health and Human Services. And also Andrew Rice, who is Executive Director of Variety Care Foundation, which provides support for Variety Care and its about approximately 15 clinics located around the state serving the uninsured and underinsured. Let's start with a question for Terry. The Affordable Care Act has run into a lot of resistance here. No Medicaid expansion. At the same time, things are about to change. The public exchange, the healthcare marketplace goes online in just 1 week from today, I believe. And that will bring some changes. It will tear down some barriers for getting health insurance. For example, you can no longer be denied coverage for a pre-existing condition. There will be no annual or lifetime caps on coverage. So it opens the doors. At the same time, in Oklahoma, in the context of this state, we have some of the most abysmal health outcomes in the nation, whether it's obesity or cancer or heart disease or even dental care. Do you think now the Affordable Care Act will make a difference in improving the overall health of Oklahomans?
David, thank you very much for the question. And also, let me start by thanking Oklahoma Watch for sponsoring this exchange of ideas and information. I think this is an incredibly important topic for our state and certainly for individuals and families who will be directly impacted by the Affordable Care Act. And Affordable Care Act, it goes by several different names. I'll just use the ACA and Affordable Care Act if that's okay with you. There is no doubt that access to quality, affordable health care is good. It's good for Oklahomans. It's good for people across our country. I think that there is some hope that some of the changes that will be made, like around preventive care and other services, actually will lead to positive health outcomes. I think there also is a measure of concern about what those outcomes may be. Will they be as robust as they need to be as our country invests billions of dollars in this enterprise. I'll give you one very quick example of my concern, because I see this every single day where I work. My office is actually located right in the heart of kind of a medical community. And in that medical community, we have the highest concentration of healthcare in the entire state of Oklahoma. We have more hospital beds, we have more physicians, we have more nurses, we have various schools of training for healthcare professionals, and that care is actually free. So it goes sliding scale fee, it goes all the way down to zero. And I can walk two blocks from that high concentration of healthcare and see the worst health outcomes in the entire state. So that's a huge concern for me when I think about kind of a magic bullet or a single issue that may address these health outcomes. Very, very, sounded like such a simple question, but it's really a very complex answer. And I don't believe that it's just about access to that health care. I think that access to that true access, competently delivered health care is very important. Are we providing that in the right languages? Are we doing that in a culturally acceptable manner? It's not an easy task to do that. It's an important element. Making sure that people actually will avail themselves of those services if they're offered free of charge or for a nominal fee. So it becomes very complicated. But there is no doubt in my mind that having access, kind of that triple aim, high quality, low cost, accessible health care that's focused on improving health outcomes, that's good for the people of Oklahoma. Will we get that with the ACA? I think that's to be determined.
Andrew, same question for you, but a point I guess I would take from what Terry says is that critics of Obamacare, and we can refer to it as Obamacare, so many people do, will say, you know, a lot of people's health depends so much on personal choice. You know, you choose to smoke, you're overweight, you engage in risky behavior. So how is a program like this health care law going to overcome that? Will it make a difference in people's health in Oklahoma?
Well, it's great to be here tonight. Thank you for putting this on. This is a complex law, and it's great to be able for us. Although I think Terry and I are a little uncomfortable with being considered experts, or I don't know if we're considered experts. There's clearly a lot about the law that is I don't know. And I think that we see it at Variety Care, which is a community health center, and we're the largest community health center in the state. About 40% of our patients are uninsured. Interestingly, many of those adult uninsured work. They just don't have insurance that's provided at their employer because of cost. And so we definitely see those who are able to avail themselves on a sliding fee to get access to primary care on a regular basis. We are able to make much farther inroads on issues like wellness and making impacts on their chronic conditions because they have access to a doctor who can help them manage that. The opposite of that would be a case I had a referral actually that came through me recently from a former colleague in the legislature who had a constituent who was uninsured and has a health condition that's worsening. So I talked to the constituent's wife on the phone, and he had a condition that looks like, I'm no physician, but probably may have to go outside of the primary care sector that we work in and see specialty care. And I said to the wife, how long has it been since he's been to a doctor? She said, oh, it's been several years because he doesn't have any insurance. And without going into specifics, it seems like perhaps his condition is one that if it were caught earlier, could have been better. And so that's a case of because of the monetary barrier that his family had to good access to quality care, perhaps his condition is going to be worse and may end up where a lot of our uninsured have ended up in years up until now with the passage of this law at OU, at our other hospital systems, having to be admitted for more expensive care and which gets shifted onto the taxpayer. So I think that that's sort of an example of the old system. My hope is that the ACA will address a lot of those issues, better access, better cost savings by catching things earlier, and they're not, rather than the scenario that he may be involved in, which is talk to any hospital executive in this town or this state, having someone who's uninsured show up and needs to be admitted to their hospital is a huge expense to the hospital, which gets shifted onto the taxpayer. So wellness, I do believe, is talking to our providers, is easier to do when you have a medical home of environment for that patient to regularly come in and get wellness checkups. Doing dental wellness with mothers and their babies when the moms are in the dental chair and the toddlers in the dental chair is easier than perhaps trying to sort of persuade people to come out to an event like this and do wellness. So we in the community health center movement do believe that wellness is easier with access. because you're in there with a physician and you can pick up on things.
One question, in the clinics out there in the trenches, are people asking about the Affordable Care Act and what's coming and what benefits they might get? What does the knowledge level seem to be?
We definitely are getting a lot of questions. Some people are a little bit more informed about the complexities of the law than others, but actually was just told today by our, we got a federal grant to hire several navigators who are people who will help anyone, whether they utilize our providers or not, help them navigate the exchanges, which would go live in a week, and which are marketplaces. I describe it as sort of an Amazon.com type of site where people can shop and compare plans. So I found out today that yesterday at our largest community health center, Straka Terrace, which is a 40,000 square foot family practice center on the south side of Oklahoma City, an individual came in yesterday asking about the exchanges, and our front office person explained that they're not available to enroll yet, that our navigators will be available in about a week. And the word I got was that this individual started to cry and said that he and his wife have such mounting medical bills that they really are anxious for it to get going. He was more upset that the fact that the plans would not go into effect until January 1. He could wait a week to enroll, but he was anticipating that the plan started October 1st. So that's just one anecdote of, obviously, there are some people out there that are anxious to sort of wrestle with it and see what sort of access that they may get that they previously don't have. So.
Mm-hmm. Terry, speaking of getting information out there, as Oklahoma Watch, we had a story not too long ago about how the state is not really taking a lot of proactive steps to reach out to people. Up in the state in Montana, the insurance commissioner up there is traveling the state conducting town forums, declaring that there are no partisan purposes, simply want to give people the information to make the right choices. Even the State Department of Health website here, if it has a very nice-looking web page, all the links go straight to the federal site that we've seen. Should the state be doing more to reach out to Oklahomans to tell them what's coming in 1 week with the arrival of this health care marketplace?
Let me explain a little bit about what the state is doing. And I can't speak, of course, for the insurance commissioner, but I can speak for what we've done in my area of state government. We have, in part, waiting for additional information. So I'm the Cabinet Secretary for Health and Human Services. We have convened all of the Health and Human Services agencies, which are the agencies that are most likely to get those questions from individuals. We have, just within the Department of Health, it's kind of to the clinic question, we have 69 county health departments spread across the entire state. We are getting those questions. People come in the door. They're used to being able to ask whatever question that's health-related right there because that's an entity that they're familiar with in their particular community. We have not received federal funding to disseminate this information or push this information. The federally qualified health centers have received some of that through HRSA, which is one of the federal agencies. There are entities across the country that have, just within the last month, I guess, August 15th, were notified of their awards to take on that educational role in communities, receive large grants to push that information out across the state. We were not one of those entities. There are two within the state of Oklahoma, two grantees that were awarded that money. But when we convened the Health and Human Services Cabinet agencies, as Andrew said earlier, these issues are incredibly complex, and we don't know all the details, and that information's emerging almost on a daily basis. People who have been trained are receiving that training to be the navigators, to be the certified application counselors. They're just getting the tip of the iceberg, so there'll be a lot more information coming. So we really see as one of our primary roles, the governor has been very, very clear. She wants to make sure that people have access to accurate information. The ACA is the law. It is a federal law. It's in place. Whether you like that or not, it's the law of the land. We need to make sure that people have accurate information. So pulling together the Health and Human Services agencies, we talked about those resources that are available. We want to make sure that those agencies, when they receive that question, they actually are putting people in touch who have the latest up-to-date information. So there's a website, healthcare.gov, which is a resource that everyone should be familiar with. That'll put you right there. There's an 800 number, 1-800-319-2596. That also will connect people to that information. Those are two of the resources that we're pushing out. We want to make sure that people go straight to the accurate federal resources to get that. And I've actually called those numbers, and I can tell you there was a little bit of confusion on the other end of the line, in part because those services are not available until October 1st. So the governor is very, very clear. She wants accurate information for people who are interested in that. And if people are making those inquiries, we want to make sure that they have that information available, an accurate source.
That's some of the experiences we've had for our reporters calling the feds to get information about
this. I mean, it's a heavy lift.
It's picking up.
It's understandable that there will be a deluge of requests for information. And I think it's important for people to remember you don't have to sign up on October 1st. You can actually unless you have a really pressing issue and you need to do that, you may want to wait a little bit and wait for some of those calls to be answered. Mm-hmm. And there will be a little bit more information, a little more time, and probably less stress on that system.
I'd like to open up questions to the audience.
Now, I don't know whether to blame this on the fact where I don't hear very good or I'm just old, period. But it seems to me like basically you guys are telling us that this is going to be available, but you don't really know for sure exactly what is going to be available, and that's what the navigators and stuff like that are going to be for.
I'll say that I can definitely give you generalities of what will be available. I think that there's lots of specific scenarios that are unclear now. For instance, someone who may be HIV positive, there's some care that goes into the plan they sign up for and how it relates to federal Ryan White money they get. So those are some very sort of specific niche types of scenarios. But generally, it's important to know that the plans on the exchange that you can begin enrolling on, and the commissioner's right, October 1st is when you can begin enrolling. That does not mean coverage starts then. Coverage starts in January. So that is a good point. There's not really a need to rush right in. But generally, these are private insurance plans. These are not government plans. So this, I think the three providers so far in Oklahoma that have posted, Blue Cross.
I think there are five altogether, two HMOs and three other carriers.
There are carriers. And so there will be all different types, generally what they consider bronze, silver, and gold level type of plans. The bronze would be more sort of generally what we're used to as sort of the more high deductible catastrophic type of coverage, so won't cover a lot of costs for doctor's visits and pharmaceuticals, but if something really bad happens, most of your costs at the hospital will be covered all the way up to the other end of the spectrum. The one thing that I think is very important but doesn't get sort of reported a lot is for people at different income levels who go to the exchange to purchase a plan, there are tax credits from the federal government that are available that they are eligible for that will reduce the monthly premium. This is where it gets a little mathematical, so I'll just try to be very simplistic. Those tax credits start for people at 100% of the federal poverty level. Not at the federal poverty level, but one times the federal poverty level. So 100% of the federal poverty level up to 400% of the federal poverty level. And just to give you an idea, if you're a family of four, so two parents and two children, 400% of the federal poverty level is $92,000 a year. So the tax credit that you'd be eligible at that level will not be as generous as it is for those people at 100% of the poverty level, which is a poorer income bracket. They have the option when you sign up on the plan. So you find a plan that you think is a good fit for you. And I don't really know why a consumer, frankly, would not choose this, but there may be some that aren't. You have the option to have the tax credit incorporated into your cost. So say it's a $325 monthly premium, and once they deduct, put your tax credit in, it reduces it to $275. When you choose that, you pay $275 a month, and then the private provider, the insurance provider, works with the IRS to get the credit. You don't have to deal with it on your tax return and that. So that's the general lay of the land of the private plans that are available to enroll in October 1st.
The one thing I would add to that is there is an essential benefits package, kind of a core set of services that all of those providers that are providing services through the marketplace are required to provide. And it does get complicated. You have different essential services for men, different services for women, because you have different things that may be covered in terms of screening or types of services, and different essential services for children.
Smokers and non-smokers.
Right. So it starts to get a little bit complicated with all of those, does it or does it not cover that. That website, and this is a little bit long and it may be on there, there's actually an extension just beyond that. If you put a backslash and then you said, what does marketplace health insurance cover? It's like the longest URL you could imagine. It will list all of those essential services for you. And you can actually go in and queue into those. So just a great resource.
There's also, I believe, the Kaiser Family Foundation which is a national foundation, different from the George B. Kaiser Foundation in Tulsa. They have a calculator on their site that's very user-friendly where you can plug in your income level and things, and it can give you scenarios ahead of the plans of generally what different plans may. It's our income calculators and give people an idea.
I think we have a question.
We should probably note that the part of the Affordable Care Act that starts a week from now is designed primarily for people who can't get health insurance through an employer and who don't receive coverage under Medicaid or Medicare or any of the existing public programs. There are at least 400,000 people in this state in that category. It's about 1 out of 10 of the population. The five companies that have applied to provide those policies are Aetna, Blue Cross, Coventry, Global Health, and Community Care. Some of the information is available publicly. Some of it's not yet available. On October 1, it's all supposed to be available. I'm curious. I mean, this phase of Obamacare is set to begin a week from today. Friday, the U.S. House voted to defund the Affordable Care Act. Today, a filibuster began in the U.S. Senate. You've got a few years of politics under your belt. As an astute political observer, how do you calculate the odds that this will take effect a week from now? And then secondly, why is this such an emotional, visceral issue for so many people in Oklahoma, other than the obvious, which is that President Obama is not that popular in the state? But beyond that, why do people have such strong feelings on this particular subject?
I think it's important to look at the history. There was a long process, even before the president got elected. You go back four presidential administrations, both Democrat and Republican, there's been tremendous amounts of research, study, arguments, commissions into what to do about the issue of the uninsured and rising costs. Of course, under the Clinton administration and Hillary's efforts, but also in both Bush administrations, there's a lot of work to go in. My first year when I was elected to the state Senate, there's a really fantastic national nonpartisan organization called the National Conference of State Legislatures, and it's made up of Democrat, Republican, and independent legislators from all over the country who get together for conferences for 3 or 4 days on a certain issue. And I got sent, because I was named co-chair of the health committee, to one on health care. And it was in Chicago. And there was a lot of really great panels and workshops that whole weekend. But the one that really stuck out to this day was I sat in on a panel on the Massachusetts plan, the health care reform plan. And you had representatives from the democratically controlled legislature. You had representatives from then Governor Romney's office. And you had some independent think tank people, Heritage Foundation and others. And it was a really fascinating history lesson for me on the sort of the long process they got to in Massachusetts of sort of getting to what became that law, of which in a very general way, the Affordable Care Act is modeled on, as far as the individual mandate forcing people into large pools. So I think that's important to realize is that generally when this whole debate started right after the president got elected, you had the Democrats sort of maybe unrealistically wanting a single-payer system. You had some Republicans unrealistically saying, don't do anything. And this, for better or worse, is sort of what they came up with. One last thing very briefly I'll say. I am a personal proponent of the individual mandate from this standpoint. When I was elected, you were required as a state employee and as a state legislator to enroll in the state health insurance program, which was a private plan that the state contracted out. And I remember asking the enrollment benefit coordinator at the Senate why that was. And the explanation I got was, one, the more people in the pool of the state of Oklahoma, public employees, that they had the bigger bargaining power that the state had with whatever private insurance company they were going to go with. But two, it creates, which the way the HMO system started years ago, it forces a very large pool of enrollees who all have very, very different types of backgrounds. I was 33 years old when I was elected, almost never went to the doctor, thank goodness. My executive assistant was quite a bit older, quite a bit unhealthier. My premium dollars in that same pool were helping offset her medical costs. That's harder to do when you have a smaller pool of just healthy people. And that's one of the economic rationales, I guess, whether you agree with it or not, or whether it'll work or not, behind the mandate. Someone who's uninsured today, whose appendix blows up, and they go down the street here to OU, they're going to get their appendix taken out, thank goodness, I believe, in a country that will not let people, you know, die. But that's going to be picked up by the taxpayer. So that's sort of the idea of getting people under plans and spreading that cost around and hopefully bringing premiums down. That's some of the economics behind the law.
Terry, I have a question about the Oklahoma plan that's been talked about, and Insure Oklahoma. You've got a 1-year extension on that program. Is it going to survive? What's your prediction? What are your thoughts about how this will play out over the next year?
Great question. And many people may not be aware. Oklahoma actually developed a plan through the Medicaid agency called Insure Oklahoma that insures about 30,000 individuals now. That plan was set to sunset at the end of December, and the state was notified by CMS, the Medicaid agency, that waiver would not be renewed. And in part, the belief at that time was, on the part of CMS, was that everyone would be covered, and you wouldn't need that. But as the systems have evolved and changed over time, we know that a large number of states, about half states, actually are not expanding Medicaid. Oklahoma is one of those states that's not expanding Medicaid. Then it took that option off the table. Those individuals indeed would not be. So the governor has fought very hard to get a one-year extension for Insure Oklahoma. It's a fantastic program that has very, very popular in the state. It's limited because it has a limited amount of financing and has different elements. The employer segment of that employer-sponsored piece of Insure Oklahoma actually blends funding sources, which has a lot of appeal in Oklahoma. So you have state and federal resources provide about 60% of the funding for that coverage. About 25% is then paid by that small business, and about 15% is paid by the individual. So it blends all of those funding sources together, and then the individual actually is able to purchase their insurance in the private marketplace. So it's not purchasing that through the Medicaid program. It's actually doing that in the private marketplace, and it's been very, very popular.
Any chance?
There were multiple messages coming from the administration that this program would not survive beyond December 31st. The governor had direct conversations with the president. She had direct conversations with Secretary Sebelius, really helping to educate those individuals about the importance of this program and the qualities that it brings to the state. And CMS agreed recently that they would extend that for 1 year. We think it's an important foundational element of coverage in the state of Oklahoma, and of course we'd like to see that extended beyond that. Now we're focused on this year.
Quick question. Any chance the state will kick in more money for that program, do you think?
Well, the state has, again, a little realized fact is that the state and the legislature have almost every single year put in additional monies for Medicaid and the Medicaid agency. This last year, there was about $50 million, $45 to $50 million that were appropriated new monies for the Medicaid agency, actually expecting that there would be, through all these conversations, increased awareness about coverage, that you would have individuals who are eligible for Medicaid who had not applied, who now would apply because they're concerned about it, they're hearing more about it, and we needed to make sure that they had access to care. So almost every single year, we have seen additional dollars from the state legislature to provide additional Medicaid services to people in the state of Oklahoma. It's been small. It's been incremental. It hasn't been a Massachusetts plan where all of a sudden you're covering everyone. It's been much more methodical, much more systematic and incremental in that increase.
You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. Today, the feature is a panel discussion hosted by the nonprofit journalism organization Oklahoma Watch about the Affordable Care Act and its implementation in Oklahoma. The moderator is Oklahoma Watch executive editor David Fritzy. On the panel is Andrew Rice, a former Oklahoma senator from 2006 to 2012, and now executive director of the Variety Care Foundation. Variety Care is a community health center for insured and uninsured individuals who have problems getting access to health care services. Also on the panel is Terry Klein, Oklahoma Commissioner of Health since 2009, and since 2011, also the Oklahoma Cabinet Secretary for Health and Human Services. He has served in a variety of national and state roles dealing with health, mental health, and substance abuse. We rejoin the program as David Fritzy invites questions from the audience.
Any other questions out there about any specifics of what's coming up?
My question is from my granddaughter. She works 30 hours a week, makes $9 an hour, and I figured it up. I think it comes up to like about $14,000 a year. I've heard 100% of the federal poverty level, and I've heard 130%. I think there's a dollar amount of the poverty level. Is that like about $1,100 or something like that? Not quite $1,200?
It's about
11,000
some odd
for a single person.
1,100, 11,000, yeah.
That's the poverty level.
So she's above.
Does she have
that.
Children in the home or?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
And she's single or married?
She's single. Yeah. Is she going to be able to, you know, since she won't be eligible for Medicaid because there won't be any Medicaid in Oklahoma for adults, will she be able to, at that income, will she? I didn't quite understand when you said 100%, or is that 100% over 100% of the federal poverty level?
So one, you pinpointed one thing that I think I'll clarify real quick. That so there is an overlap. Medicaid expansion in states that are doing it covers people to 133% in states that are doing it. And for the moment, I'm hopeful, but for the moment, we're not doing that. The tax credits that are available to help offset the costs start at 100% and up. So there are going to be people in that 33% window there. I don't know what, at $9 an hour, if someone can calculate it.
It was about $14,000.
$14,000, that's probably between 0 and 100% of poverty, would be my guess. She will not, there will be no Medicaid, and there will be no tax credit. This is one of the things that the OK Policy Institute has talked about. There was just an unintended consequence. I think when the law was crafted, there probably was ideas that the Supreme Court may weigh in on it, but I don't think there was ever an anticipation that the Supreme Court would allow the mandate as a tax, but give the states the option whether to expand Medicaid. So it's an unintended coverage crater. So at 0% of poverty, you've got a crater to 100% of people that will not give coverage. They can't afford, they won't be able to afford it on the exchanges probably because they're currently not. These are $9 an hour. There will not be a penalty. The little teeny silver lining is there's no penalty for people who would be covered under Medicaid expansion, but there's no coverage as well. So.
She needs insurance. She has had a hearing disability from birth. So, you know, hearing aids, just, and everybody needs to be able to go to the doctor.
The Insure Oklahoma plan that the commissioner talked about.
You have to be self-employed, though, or work for
Say again.
Business.
They're self-employed. Self-employed. There is a self-employed option currently. It's less funded, or there's more of a limit to that than the employer-based option. There's a consulting group out of Utah, the former governor of Utah, who was the Health and Human Services Secretary, I believe, under President Bush. His consulting group came in at the request of the Healthcare Authority and did a study on, if we're not going to do Medicaid expansion, what are alternatives on how we could cover the population that your daughter falls into. And there was the suggestion that Insure Oklahoma and the Center for Medicaid and Medicare in Washington has given indications to states like Arkansas and others that there is an openness for the feds to allow a similar funding mechanism to flow into a program like Insure Oklahoma to cover people like your daughter. It would not be Medicaid. There would be quite a bit of federal money, but it would be much like the exchange. It would be private plans that could be bought. Now, I think probably from what I've read and who I've talked to, it will be different if that ever happens in Oklahoma, in that the employee, either self-employed person like your daughter or the $9 an hour employee, will not be required to pay any part of the premium. Currently, the employee pays a small. I got my oil changed at a place here, and I was chit-chatting with the guy who was doing it, and he was on the Insure Oklahoma program and somehow lost coverage. And he raved about how much he liked it. His portion of it, it's private insurance, was $40 a month. And he has COPD. So now he's uninsured with COPD and has no coverage. So, but under the possible expanded scenario, the individual would not be required to cover any part of the premium because it has to mimic Medicaid expansion as much as possible. So it would be mostly federal and state money and some employer money if they were employed. That's not stated in policy. I'm just going off what we know Health and Human Services and CMS are telling states that are considering this. And I think it was in the Levitt report there was some stuff about there would be some changes more pro-consumer to Insure Oklahoma if it was ever utilized by the state legislature and the governor to allow for an immense expansion to cover people who would be covered under Medicaid expansion.
She works for a grocery store in Tulsa, and they provide insurance, but not for 30-hour
part-time
people. And are you sure that she falls below the federal?
I'm not. I mean, those of you who have Wi-Fi right now.
I think actually she's slightly above the federal poverty level.
So she would be eligible for a tax credit on the exchange.
And a big one.
Okay.
Yeah, my understanding is they're the largest at 100%, and they get smaller the higher up the income scale you go to 400%. And in Tulsa, a great asset for her other than Oklahoma Watch statewide would be for her to go to Morton Health Center, which
is
Morton, M-O-R-T-O-N, is the equivalent of Variety Care in Tulsa, and they have navigators that will be employed to help people uninsured navigate the system.
Another question?
Terry, can you speak to where the governor's office is on the Leavitt report?
Sure. As Senator Rice had noted, the Leavitt report was a commissioned report from the Leavitt Partners, a group out of Utah, which had done a great deal of work in Medicaid and health exchanges, and they commissioned their group to come together and provide a series of recommendations to the state of Oklahoma. So there really was kind of a menu of recommendations that were provided. At the core of those recommendations was this idea of building on this foundation of Insure Oklahoma and really using that as a foundation for our Medicaid program in the state of Oklahoma. It has, again, a lot of those elements that are very familiar to Oklahomans and very comfortable in terms of individual accountability and contributions to the program. The governor has been focused on the Insure Oklahoma extension. That really has been the centerpiece of focus for her, making sure those individuals who just in a couple of months would have been dropped from their coverage. So we have been focused almost singularly on that aspect of Medicaid and those negotiations with CMS. So that has really delayed any further review of the Leavitt plan at this point. Prior to that news, there's a great deal of interest in really trying to understand what is the best fit for the people of Oklahoma, what is the most responsible fiscally in the state of Oklahoma, what can we learn from other states. There's a huge amount as states are learning. And if you talk with anyone in Massachusetts, they'll tell you about the escalating costs there, the concern around out-of-control budgets that are very concerning. So is there a way to expand Medicaid that does not incur that kind of fiscal escalation? We don't know. We certainly haven't seen that. There are other plans in other states. So we've heard a lot about the Arkansas plan, which really provides individuals with the option of purchasing private health care, which is one of those fundamental elements that we have in the Insure Oklahoma plan. It's already there. Like Oregon, which is using an accountable care organization model, really looking at smaller regional areas that have overall responsibility for the health outcomes in those particular areas. Very, very interesting concept because it's not focused just on reimbursing. Right now, we really have a volume-based system in our health care. If I'm a provider, the more times you come in to see me, the more times you'll get paid. That doesn't necessarily equate to improved health outcomes for that particular individual. We hope it does, and in many situations it does. But there also are times where we may be providing tests or running tests that are not necessarily leading to positive health outcomes. So there are some models that are actually being rolled out in other states where there is a shift in those incentives for providers. We're not going to pay you just because you're providing more diagnostic tests. Will that diagnostic test make a difference in the health outcome for that individual? It really shifts the focus to overall outcomes rather than having a volume-based fee-for-service model, which is the model that most of the country has in health care today.
Well, and I will say you're right, but community health centers are not, and I just want to pinpoint some of the good progresses have made. And contrary to what maybe some Oklahomans think, we are incentivized and are reimbursed from Medicaid, which is a very efficient payer for us, on a bundled rate. So we are not on a fee-for-service, and that is a problem. But more frankly, more so in the private side than in the community health side. So a child that comes to Variety Care to see a pediatrician, we are reimbursed an enhanced bundled rate to take care of that child and keep them well. And it's up to us whether we're going to be efficient or inefficient with those dollars. So if we were to be irresponsible about excess testing, it would be at our economic detriment. Same goes with dental and other things. So contrary to what may be said, there are some of the more politicized debates about Medicaid. Medicaid with community health centers has got very innovative reforms in place where we are incentivized to show more quality outcomes. And the better job we do at keeping people well, then the economics work for us. So I know that I speak for a lot of other community health people that we would hope that that would sort of be expanded to the rest of the healthcare system, what we have, which is not fee for service, but bundled.
And are there lessons to be learned from that model?
And it's working well for us, and it's good for the patient. So,
other questions?
Commissioner Klein, with the passage of the Affordable Health Care Act, the federal government offered states, including Oklahoma, millions of dollars to set up exchanges, hire people to tell them how to go through it, and give out information. Governor Fallon turned that down. Does that not put us in Oklahoma behind the eight ball as far as getting the word out about what it's about, how to do the exchanges? We don't have access to the expertise of people who are would have been paid with that money as other states. Isn't that a problem for us here in Oklahoma?
Actually, those services are available based on those individuals who applied for the grants to provide those services. So we have two entities in the state of Oklahoma who applied to become navigators that will be providing those services and resources across the state. One of those is actually kind of a consortium of the community health centers through the Primary Care Association and others. And then the federally qualified health centers also receive money from the federal government to make sure that outreach is occurring. The other is a Little Dixie Action Agency that applied for and received funding through that. I know that there were other entities in the state of Oklahoma who applied to be navigators who did not receive those grants. So there were more people making those requests to become navigators than actually receive those, as you would expect in any kind of grant process. So those resources are available. The individuals I've talked with who are actually providing that, again, they just received notification that they are to provide that service on August 15th. And they found out at the exact same time that the rest of the world found out in terms of media release around the awarding of those grants. So that's what I mean. It's a heavy lift. There's a lot of information. Those individuals, I think, deserve our support. They've taken on that task and that heavy lift to provide that information to the state, and it's evolving constantly. So they've taken on a task. They have just a matter of weeks to actually learn and be trained to provide that. They're learning the particulars of those responsibilities for those grants, and that information is not immediately forthcoming because it hasn't all been developed yet.
I should mention that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that I think we have people who want to buy off the marketplace have until the end of March, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct.
They do.
Question here?
It sounds like the estimates are about 150,000 people are not going to be part of the Medicaid expansion. It seems like they're the sickest, neediest, and most in need people in Oklahoma that would be helped and brought up, you know, and be able to be more productive if Medicaid expansion was allowed. Do you think the governor rejecting Medicaid expansion was a mistake?
I don't believe that was a mistake. One thing that people need to realize is that Oklahoma has had the option of expanding Medicaid since the inception of the Medicaid program. So Massachusetts is the prime example. As a state, decisions were made to expand Medicaid and to cover every single person in the state of Massachusetts. That decision was made long before President Obama went into office. That's an option that is available, has been available, was available, and legislatively, that has not been the will of the legislature, or I would say the will of the people in terms of prioritizing health care for all people in the state of Oklahoma. With a limited pool of resources, there are difficult decisions to be made in terms of those priorities. Is it about lower taxes and putting more money in the pockets of individuals? Is it about making sure that there are additional scholarships for individuals in terms of higher education? Is it about making sure that you have roads? Those are all, as Senator Rice knows, are very, very complex questions that have been before the legislature and policymakers for years and years. And our state has had the option of doing that in the past and chose not to.
Andrew, you see your clinic see lots of people who aren't covered and who will not be covered.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a mistake. There's a great study out there. I'm going to use my dad as an example. He's here tonight. I hope he doesn't mind. But my dad was lucky as an adult from the time he was a young adult until he hit Medicare, to have private insurance and have a medical home with a private family practice physician who could keep him healthy, see him regularly, and if any chronic conditions emerged, help him stay healthy. Take someone born on the same year, in 1939, who, when the time they hit 19, has been uninsured their whole life, had no access to a physician. They episodically get to go to OU when things get really bad, and the state legislature appropriates a lot of money to take care of them then, rather than $200 or $300 a month they could have been spending to keep them healthy, pay thousands and thousands of dollars to deal with them at the emergency room. They hit Medicare. It's not like Medicare can say, I'm not taking you, I'm taking you. Medicare takes everybody. Think how expensive that second person is to the Medicare system. There's a great study about how having exactly what David was saying, this is the most expensive part of the population, the people who would be covered on Medicaid expansion. We are actually costing ourselves way much more money by not covering them. You know, it's a huge bad mistake as far as investment. So the other thing I would say is, although I would be grateful if we come to some sort of compromise as Insure Oklahoma as an alternative, because as working in the provider network, we just want people to get coverage. We see what it means for them. We are much more able to take care of them and keep them well and save the system money. Let me tell you, when adult uninsured patients or medically expanded eligible patients are kept out of the OU and St. Anthony and Integris emergency room, we are saving the taxpayers money. But the alternative through Insure Oklahoma is more expensive. If you have someone, an adult, who would be covered on a Medicaid, Medicaid only pays Variety Care or St. Anthony when they go to Variety Care or St. Anthony for that visit. The Insure Oklahoma program means that federal money is going to go to those private insurance plans every month, whether that person's utilizing health care or not. So it's actually going to be a more expensive solution, I think, is a pretty objective way to look at it. But beggars can't be choosers. I think that we got to do something, and we could talk about the hit that this has to the hospitals as well. This is a huge detriment to the hospitals, not having some sort of offset.
We have a question from the press section here.
Yes, Dr. Klein, I had a question if there's a timeline on the governor making a decision on the Levitt Partners' recommendations. I mean, are we going to be sitting here next year saying that, well, the governor was busy trying to get the extension renewed on Insure Oklahoma, so we didn't have time to focus on implementing or rejecting the Levitt Partners' recommendations?
So the Levitt plan actually has several different recommendations. There are different pieces of that that may have appeal or may not have appeal. I think in those conversations that the governor has had with the administration, there's an important educational piece that's taking place about this, what we really consider to be foundational plan in the state of Oklahoma. So although I've described that focus on this and really the importance of making sure these individuals who are currently covered do not lose that coverage, and they now have additional coverage for a year. At the same time, there's been an incredible amount of education with the administration about this program and the utility of this program in the state. So I think that that has been useful in furthering that cause down the road. I think that will lead to additional conversations about how this program, Insure Oklahoma, really is fundamental to the state, and hopefully the federal government will recognize, which the federal government, by the way, too, has the ability. Every single state in our country operates its Medicaid program through a waiver program. So basically what that means is there's a core set of services that get provided, but every state is different. I mean, this is really a fundamental element for Medicaid programs across our country, and several states have multiple waivers. So those are the exceptions that get granted by the federal government to allow individual plans to develop based on the needs of that particular state or resources within that particular state. So this really has been the way that we have operated that business. The question is, would the federal government entertain a waiver that would allow Oklahoma to have a program that's unique to this state, that's based on those fundamentals of Insure Oklahoma, that will allow additional people to be covered under that? Some individuals will be covered who were covered under Insured Oklahoma may now be covered under the marketplace. Those individuals may decide that they're going to be covered for that because we have a limited pool of money. That may mean that there will be some additional individuals who can now be covered under that plan who are not. Again, it's limited by a finite amount of information, which, as you mentioned, is the way we do business in the state of Oklahoma. We actually balance our budget every single year. We're required to do that. So we're living within that. So if we can be more efficient, if we can cover people through the waiver in Insure Oklahoma in additional ways, we're very interested in exploring that. So the Leavitt plan actually has some of those elements embedded in it. The governor has been very clear that she wants to make sure that people do not lose coverage. She is really, again, this kind of triple aim, which is a fundamental element for healthcare transformation, is really making sure that we have more people who have access to care. We want to make sure that that's quality care, and we want to bend that cost curve. A very, very clear recognition. You can talk about how important these services are. I did a lot of work in the nonprofit sector as well. There's a fundamental line, which is also true in state government: no money, no mission. You can talk about what you want to do all day long. If you can't figure out a way to fund that, then you can't provide those services. And in the private sector, it may be fundraising, it may be any number of resources that are available to you. In government, you need to make sure that you're living realistically within that budget. So looking for those efficiencies, are there ways to bring down healthcare cost or at least bend that curve? What we know is if we stay on this trajectory, we will bankrupt this country. When you hear General Motors talking about we're spending more on healthcare than we're spending in the steel that we put in our cars, that system is broken. It is fundamentally broken. So we can't simply expand that system. We need to do those things that Senator Rice talked about in terms of finding models that actually work, that address, improve health care outcomes, and bring down those costs.
I'd like to go back to something that Andrew mentioned, but I'd also like you to respond to it as well, Terry, about rural hospitals. I'm concerned about the Colgates and the Hobarts and the Alvas that are some distance away from major hospitals, and how the loss of the DSH payments and other types of things are going to affect those hospitals and affect the life of rural Oklahoma. Most of our questions today have been focused in the metro areas. I think that there's going to be a substantial impact, different impact in the rural areas, and be interested in not only how you think it's going to roll out, but also what some of the solutions could be.
The choice not to expand Medicaid is a real devastating blow, particularly to rural hospitals, even more than urban hospitals, although it's bad for urban hospitals. And to give you an example, just as I explain this, just very briefly, of the political side of it, I had someone who's involved with what we do, a former constituent, emailed me a response that Senator Inhofe sent them about them expressing their disappointment about the defunding Obamacare. And it was sort of a set response that, you know, people on both sides have. And in there, it said sort of very sort of simplistically, Obamacare will be bad for America, blah, 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 because of the Medicare cuts. Now, that's an example of where politicians are being irresponsible. There are Medicare cuts as part of the Affordable Care Act because, very generally, and you probably know more about this than me, but you can correct me, very generally, over the last 20 years of rising health care costs and losses in the health care system for the uninsured, one of the things that CMS has done with Medicare for places like OU and Saints and Integris is they have increased the reimbursements of Medicare for lots of general procedures to help the hospital cover their losses. So when an uninsured person gets admitted, or you've got a preemie baby that's in the NICU for 2 months and you've lost a lot of money, Medicare reimbursements have been increased to help cost that. So with the Affordable Care Act, which is all about economics and about creating revenue streams for people to get coverage, one of the reasons why what Senator Inhofe left off is, yes, Medicare is getting cut because you have these offsetting sources of revenue that will fill in that lost revenue. Medicaid expansion, private plans from the exchanges. So what you have in states that are not expanding Medicaid is you have a double haircut. You have Medicare's being cut, and you are saying no to one of the strongest sources of offsetting revenue. So I think the OHA has put out a study that in the first 9 months to a year here of no Medicaid expansion, there's the potential of 30% of our rural hospitals going under because of finances. That's just the basics. So it's a huge issue. And I think that the state will have to find, they're not going to do Medicaid expansion, the Leavitt report recommendations, and that's really going to be on the government. I will say, you know, I don't know if it's CMS understanding the value of Insure Oklahoma. I mean, the Leavitt report vetted a lot of this with CMS. Arkansas has vetted this with HHS and CMS. I think the feds are willing to work with states like Oklahoma
to expand Insure Oklahoma-type programs to cover more of the uninsured, it's really going to be more on the legislatures of whether you'll do it, because it's still going to be an enormous amount of federal money to make that work. This is not a state that's in any sort of mood to appropriate new state money for anything. So it's going to have to be federal money. And that's not really on CMS or the federal government. That's going to be on the Speaker, the President Pro Tem, their caucuses, and the governor. I mean, wouldn't you agree? It's not really much on CMS.
No.
It's really on them now. I mean, we all know that there's one really big alternative, and the Levitt Report zeroed in on it, and it's going to be on them whether they're going to do it.
Part of the back channel conversation around this, and Jim's point is that he's referring to DSH payments, which are disproportionate share payments to hospitals, basically to compensate them for care that's not funded in any other way. And it's to make sure that there's adequate system of care for those individuals. In the development of the ACA, there were conversations and negotiations that took place between the American Hospital Association and the administration. And one of the trade-offs in those negotiations with the American Hospital Association was, we will give you that support because then we will be covered and we'll make sure that we still have a revenue stream when every state then allows that additional coverage through Medicaid expansion. So that was a negotiation that took place in good faith. What was not anticipated was that there would be 27 states that said, we're not going to expand Medicaid. And so now you had a huge hole that is created because those federal payments are no longer coming down to those hospitals. So I would not say that that responsibility lies entirely with the states. I would say that part of that was a negotiation that took place at the federal level between the American Hospitals Association and the administration. I think there is a serious responsibility on the part of the federal government to say, now that we recognize that the Supreme Court actually made a decision that changed our understanding of how this would play out, that we want to make sure that those hospitals stay intact in those rural areas because they're a critically important part of the network, that we want to make sure that there is some payment mechanism to recognize that in these states. So I think that there is an opportunity. I've had conversations as recently as yesterday on this topic. My understanding is that there is a conversation taking place and negotiations that would do just that, whether the federal government will then see it as their responsibility to make sure those, and you have small hospitals, as far as the DSH payments, you have small hospitals, you have critical access hospitals, there's a whole network. And I do agree with you 100% that the livelihood of those hospitals is being jeopardized. Mm-hmm. There are conversations as well at the national level and the state level about, we have some hospitals that may have 16 beds where three of those beds are full on a regular basis. So is this the time to actually question, do we want to re-engineer all of those great resources in those areas to focus on wellness, to make sure that we're focusing on outreach to individuals, to make sure that they're getting the screenings, not take those jobs away from those communities because they are critically important in those communities, but really to re-engineer the function of those hospitals in those areas. And the hospitals have to be at the table engaged in those conversations.
I think if you talk to the hospitals, I can't speak for them, providers like community health centers, we just want the revenue to be able to be there in a cost-efficient way where people get covered. So if there's alternatives and CMS is willing to work with them, that's great. But I think
part of the government piece would be, yes, we want the revenue and we want the outcomes in terms of improved health outcomes for communities and individuals.
From a personal political standpoint, I think that the thing, though, that the people of Oklahoma are going to have to sort of get their minds around is that the federal money and all these scenarios with revisiting the DSH payments are going to be a large part of the pie.
Andrew, Terry, I want to thank you for
coming,
sharing your insights.
You've been listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU with a panel discussion hosted by the nonprofit journalism organization Oklahoma Watch. It's about the Affordable Care Act and its implementation in Oklahoma. On the panel is Andrew Rice, Executive Director of the Variety Care Foundation, and Terry Klein, Oklahoma Commissioner of Health and the Oklahoma Cabinet Secretary for Health and Human Services. The moderator is Oklahoma Watch Executive Editor David Fritzy, and you can read more of their stories at oklahomawatch.org. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of KGOU or the KGOU staff or the University of Oklahoma. Patrick Roberts designed the technical setup and recorded the discussion. Karen Hulp edited the recording for broadcast. This program is a presentation of the Oklahoma Public Media Exchange.